Okay, we're finishing up the lesson on looking at the passages. We're looking at 1 Corinthians 7, looking at verse 15 in our study tonight. Before we begin our class, however, we want to go to our Heavenly Father in prayer. Bill, do you have this? We'll ask John Bright to lead us in prayer. So. Okay, if you'll open your Bibles to 1 Corinthians chapter 7, verse 15. Yet if the unbelieving one leave, let him leave. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases, but God has called us to peace. I mentioned at the end of last class, this is a key passage. It is sometimes used to defend what's called the Pauline privilege, where Jesus said, if a man puts away his wife except for fornication and marries again, he commits adultery. We understand that gives an allowance for a person to put away their mate for fornication and remarry without sin. Some believe this passage gives another reason that a person can remarry without sin, though they have a living mate. And that is if that mate deserts them. So in cases of fornication, and you divorce your mate for fornication, you can remarry without sin, Matthew 19. And then those who hold the best position on 1 Corinthians 15, if your mate deserts you, the text says you're not under bondage and therefore free to remarry. And so that's the position. If that's what the verse teaches, that's what we need to believe and that's what we need to teach. But let's look at the context and see if that is indeed what Paul was writing. We're going to appeal to the context and to the law of harmony. These are two basic rules of Bible study. So the first question we have on the lesson is about the context. Verse 12 through 15 form a section dealing with what? Being married to an unbeliever or mixed marriages. All right, so that those verses go together in that section. I could have put 12 through 16, actually. So in that context, it deals with a woman doing what? With an unbelieving mate. Live with. Look if in your Bible, you got your text open, verse 12. To the rest I say, not the Lord, that if a brother has a wife who's an unbeliever and she consents, and note these phrases, to live with him, he must not divorce her. Okay, just that verse alone tells you what the opposite of divorce is, which is what? To live with. Divorce, we've said, is the severance of the marriage relationship. That's clear in that verse, isn't it? The relationship of living together as husband and wife. Okay, now look at the next verse. A woman who has an unbelieving husband and he consents to, we have that phrase again, to live with her, she must not send her husband away. What is the parallel phrase in verse 12 to send her husband away? Divorce. So here's another verse that defines divorce for you. And so you have divorce, send her husband away. These phrases are put in opposition to living with. All right, now we go down to verse 15. Yet if the unbelieving one leaves, now he started talking about the idea of leaving back up in verse 10, didn't he? And when he talks about leaving in verse 10, what's another word for that?
Divorce.
And you know that because it says in verse 11, as a result of the leaving, she remains unmarried. So if the unbelieving one leaves, not going on a trip, not going to see the folks, it's a severance of the relationship. Let him leave. The brother or sister is not under bondage in such cases. Now, we know that the context is talking about trying to keep the marriage together, living with, don't send away. But sometimes there's nothing you can do about it, and the unbelieving mate leaves. So, the bondage that he's talking about, just based on the context, you're not bound by the law of constraint or necessity to do what? To live with. Further indication of that is the not but. He said, you're not under bondage, but what? God has called us to peace. This mate wants to leave. You say, I've got to try to live with them. I've got to try to keep them here. I'm going to force them to stay. No, that's not your job, and God doesn't expect you to do that. Although he's been saying, live with them, live with them, live with them if they'll live with you. If they leave, you're not under bondage to live with them. But God has called us to peace. Someone may say to their son, don't get rid of your car. But if someone is stealing it, let them steal it. You are not to feel bound to keep it in such cases. That is, to stop a man that's got a gun trying to steal your car. So keep your car. Don't just give it away. Don't sell it for $10 because you're ready for a new one. But, in a case where someone's stealing it, let them steal it. You're not under bondage to do what I was telling you to do. Question, is remarriage, in verse 12 through 16, is remarriage discussed at all? Sir?
Only bondage and living with.
All right, nothing about remarriage. So if I interpret not under bondage, the right to remarry, I did not get it out of this context. Did I? Not under bondage, contextually, is to live with. Now let's appeal to the law of harmony. So we've looked at the context. Matthew 5:32 and Matthew 19:9 say that whoever marries a woman who has been divorced, even though she is innocent of fornication, does what? commits adultery. How does this bear on the freedom that is not under bondage of the woman of 1 Corinthians 7:15? This man left her. Is she now a divorced woman? Can she remarry? According to Matthew 5 and 19? Can she? No. She would commit adultery. So now to interpret 1 Corinthians 7 to say you're not under bondage, that is, you're free to marry whoever you want to, how do you reconcile that with Matthew 5 and Matthew 19? That woman has been divorced or left, but if she remarries, it's adultery. I would certainly not base my argument on this, but it's just an interesting fact. If you looked up the word bondage in verse 15 and looked up the word bondage in verse 27, bound to a wife, and in verse 39, bound as long as her husband lives, and in Romans 7:2, the idea of bound by law, did anybody do that or not? Yes. What do you find? Not the same word. Not the same meaning. That's right. And so why did Paul change words? Sometimes he just uses synonyms. And again, I wouldn't base my argument on this. But the word that he used in verse 15 is a word that means to make a slave of. And so he says, you're not under bondage. You don't have to keep them. You don't have to fight to. You don't have to tie them up in a rope and tie them to a post to keep them there, even though I've told you to live with them. Okay? Any other comments on verse 15? Yes, ma'am.
What do you think about verse 16 and how does it relate to that at all, or what is your...
Live with them. He's an unbeliever. If you live with him, what potential do you have? What happened in 1 Peter 3, a woman living with a man that's not a Christian? That's right. 1 Peter 3, he said the man might be won by the behavior of his wife. And so he says, look, if you can get him to continue to live with you, maybe in time, your godly life may result in his salvation. And that's happened many, many times. And so, that's what I think is talking about, Lisa. Anybody else? All right, let's look down at verse 27 of this chapter. This is another important text in this chapter. Chapter 7 is about marriage, and he addresses various things. Before I get to verse 27, however, we know that the chapter is about marriage. And so back up in verse 8, he starts talking to what kind of people? Married people, yes, married people. In verse 25, he turns his attention to what? Virgins or unmarried people. Now, concerning virgins. Look at verse 28. If a virgin marries, look at verse 32. One who is unmarried. Would that fit a virgin? Wouldn't it? Not all unmarried people are virgins, but virgins are unmarried. Right? Verse 34, the woman who is unmarried, and namely, the virgin. Verse 36, he thinks he's acting unbecomingly toward his virgin. Verse 37, to keep his own virgin. Verse 38, he who gives his own virgin. So he's told us in 25, now I'm turning my attention to a little different facet of this subject of marriage. He told us that, and then as we go through the text and see these this word thread, we see that emphasized. Keep that in mind as we look at verse 27 and 28. All right, in verse 27, he said, are you bound to a wife? Do not seek to be released. Are you released from a wife? Do not seek a wife. But if you marry, you have not sinned. We ask the question, does released or loosed equal divorced? So he said, are you released? And so then he says, but if you marry, you have not sinned. Verse 10 and 11, the divorced woman is told to do what? Remain unmarried. If this is divorced in verse 27, what problem do you have? Contradicts himself, doesn't he? Verse 10, he says, if you divorce, remain unmarried. Verse 27, if that's divorce, he said, oh, you can marry, it's okay. Which is it? According to Matthew 5:32 and Matthew 19:9, a divorced person may be guilty of doing what if they remarry? Committing adultery. But if this is divorced in 27, he said, if you marry, you have not sinned. Does that present a problem? If you interpret released to mean divorced? In Romans 7, 1 through 3, a woman who has a living husband becomes joined to another man or married to another man. What does the text say about her and the first husband? Still bound. This verse says, are you released? And if you marry, you haven't sinned. If you translate released to be divorced, how can it not be sin when she's still bound to the first man? Okay. When we look at the English text, we see, are you released? That connotes to us. You know, words have denotation and connotation. The two words, home and house, can refer to the same thing, can't they? They denote where you live. Do they connote the same thing? Does anybody say house, sweet house? They say home, sweet home. Why? Home connotes warmth and family. But if they go to Washington, they don't say the sweet home. Or I mean the white home. The white home. They say the white house because that connotes a dwelling place. And so, released. What does that mean? We may jump to the conclusion that that implies previously bound. I've got a quote here. And that A-N-G should be A-G-B based on the acronyms at the beginning of your lesson, by the way. And it's already been corrected in the version that I will post when we're through. That's Art and Gingrich Lexicon. They have no interest in our discussion here tonight. But they are an authority on defining words. The R-W-P... That's A.T. Robertson, who was a Baptist, but a renowned Greek scholar. That's his work called Word Pictures, R.W.P. I just found it interesting what they said about this word. Robertson said, bachelors as well as widowers are included in this word that's translated loosed or released. The And Sally's not here tonight to enjoy this. The King James Version and the New King James Version and the American Standard Version translates it loosed, which really is better. You're not going to tell her I said that, are you? Are you loosed? But you can see here that that word does not necessarily mean that you were once married, because it can include bachelors and widowers. But now in Art Gingrich, he says, are you free from a wife that is not bound to a wife? Now note his statement. A previous state of being bound need not be assumed. That's that word in their language and what it meant to those people. I'll give you an illustration, Matthew 16:19. Matthew chapter 16, verse 19. Jesus said to Peter, and ultimately to all the apostles, I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth shall have been bound in heaven, and whatever you loose, and that word is from the same word that our word in our text is from, L-U-O, whatever you loose on earth shall have been loosed in heaven. Now, does anybody read that and think, well, this was a law that was previously made and is now renulled or annulled? Anybody think that? No, it's just whatever you loose, that is, you do not bind. Freedom. And so that's the idea of this word. Don't read verse 27 and conclude previous marriage or previous bond of any kind. And to further reinforce that, that's why we started at verse 25. What is this section dealing with? Virgins. People who've never been married. Are you released? That is, you're not bound. You're loosed. Simply. The New International Version, that's what that NIV stands for. I found this interesting when I had studied this previously. I have on my shelf the 1984 version. On my digital copy, I went and looked it up and it read different. But what's going on here? I went and double-checked myself. Sure enough, my bound copy, it's a 1984 version, says, are you married? Do not seek a divorce. Are you unmarried? Now, if that version is legitimate, then what does verse 28 say? Are you married? Don't seek a divorce. But what did verse 28 say?
It tells them they can be a bigamist.
Well, he said, are you married? Don't seek a divorce. Are you unmarried? Divorced? If you marry, you haven't sinned. That's not true, is it? Is it? That's not true. It's interesting, and that's interpretation instead of translation. That's the danger of some of these versions. They interpret instead of translate. Okay? That's why it's good to compare versions. You want to compare with the major versions. King James, American Standard, New American Standard, New King James. Those are the probably the best ones to compare with. Okay? But now, in the NIV 2011 version, they changed it. And they said, are you pledged to a woman? Do not seek to be released. Are you free from such a commitment? Do not look for a wife. Much better. Why did they change it? Maybe somebody put the pressure on them or called it to their attention. I don't know. I'm glad they made the change. But you can see that they themselves thought it was best to reword that text. So be careful in using one of your later translations that feel freer to tell you what the text means than rather than what the text says. Yes, Craig? That's an excellent point. Later he said, if a virgin marries, she hadn't sinned, but obviously that's not true in every case, as Craig points out. There are cases where a virgin would marry and it would be sin. Give me one. Marries a man who's divorced and still bound by law to his previous wife, Romans 7. Right. Good point, Craig. Yes, sir.
I just pointed it out with the NIV revision, but I'm just going to ask if you think it's possible that the are you bound to a wife at 27 is similar to how Joseph has talked about it. Mary has talked about it being Joseph's wife already even before they've been married.
Good point. Wife, betrothal. Good point. Wife and husband, that's the way the later version is translating it. And it's a good point that Levi brings up. You can't conclude a current marriage or a past marriage by the term husband and wife. It can refer to an anticipated marriage, a current marriage, or a past marriage. You're going to have some more data than the term husband and wife. That's a good observation.
Is there any special circumstances for the Corinthians faced where Paul recommends not being married? I mean, numerous times he said about this.
Verse 26. I think that it is good in view of the present distress that it is good for a man to remain as he is. So he started talking about virgins. Later on he talks about a man. It depends on how you read verse 34 through 37. You'll note your version has the word daughter in there, but it's in italics. That may be. I prefer the idea that it's not talking about a virgin daughter, but his virgin that he is engaged to, his fiancée. But be that as it may, you're right that normally God's law is, Genesis chapter 2, it is not good for the man to be alone. And yet Paul begins this chapter recommending against marriage. And here, this section on virgins, you see a little later, verse 34 on down, he encourages, if you can do so without sin, to remain unmarried. Why? Verse 26. There was some distress, I do not know what it was, in the Corinthian situation. That, he said, verse 32, I want you to be free from concern. One who is unmarried is concerned about the things of the Lord, how he may please the Lord, but one who is married is concerned about the things of the world, how he may please his wife. So let's say you live in Corinth. And again, I do not know what the present distress was. But let's suppose you work at a textile industry or something. And they demand that you renounce your faith in Jesus or pledge allegiance to an idol or you're going to lose your job. Obviously, your allegiance to the Lord would forbid that, but you've got a family. How are you going to feed your wife, take care of your kids? You lose your job. Does that, you think, bring a burden? You bet. And obviously when the persecution got so bad that there would be death, I'm going to kill your wife if you don't deny the name of Jesus. What are you going to do? Guy's not married, don't have that. But not a sin to marry, he goes on to say. Does that answer your question?
Yeah.
We don't know what it was, but it's
pretty harsh language at 33 and 34.
Yeah. Yeah. So unless verse 26 is the key, I don't know the answer. But that's what it looked like to me is the key as to why this particular part of this instruction is contrary to the general tenor of the Bible. Did the Lord ever recommend people not to marry? Yes. Some of you are looking doubtful. Read Matthew 19:10. The disciples said to him, "If the relationship of a man with his wife is like this, better not to marry." In other words, the Lord just laid down that rule in 9. He said to them, "Not all men can accept this statement, but only those to whom it is given. For there are eunuchs who are born that way from their mother's womb. There are eunuchs who are made eunuchs by men." Listen to this last phrase. "And there are eunuchs who made themselves eunuchs for the sake of the kingdom of heaven." He was able to accept it, let him accept it.
Don't have self-control, marry. It's better to marry than to burn. It seems like just that whole Corinthian culture of worshiping with, you know, going to the temple where there are prostitutes and just that whole thing just might have caused them to ask this question first off, and then second off might be some of the present distress of, hey, what do we, you know, we got some people still going to worship this way.
I don't know. I just, if verse 26, like I said, I can't tell you what the present distress is. I've read, does anybody else got more information on that? If you ever find any, you let me know, will you? I've not been able to find anything definitive about it, but I know it's there. Okay, good question. May not be the best answer, but a good question. Verse 39. Paul said, "A wife is bound as long as her husband lives, but if her husband is dead, she's free to be married to whom she wishes only in the Lord." Based on the contrast in this verse, what does Paul mean by bound? What? That's true, but I want the statement from the verse that defines it. Not free to be married. Your statement is correct. But in the verse, the contrast is you're either bound or you're free to be married. So bound means, just add the word not. You're not free to be married to whom you will. That's not my definition. That's the definition of the text. And we talked about this on Romans 7, why that becomes extremely important. How long is the woman bound? As long as her husband lives. And I have compared Romans. We just studied that, so we'll not go to that. Of course, this is all nice and good, but Paul wasn't really sure if he was inspired. Verse 40 said, I think I have the Spirit of God. That the meaning of that? I think I do, but I'm not sure. Sir, ma'am? It's an understatement. Parent tells their child, "Go clean your room." And I think you better do what I said. Is that a statement of doubt? Or a statement of emphasis. Somebody had a comment back here.
That was me, Steve. I was just going to say in chapter 1, verse 1 through about 3, he confirms that he has.
Right. Look at Look at Acts chapter 5, verse 36. I'll give you some examples of understatement. This is another example where being aware of figures of speech help us. Matthew 5:36. Some time ago, Judas rose up claiming to be somebody. Do you claim to be somebody? Do you? Sure, we all do. Is that what he means? Somebody important. It's an understatement to say, I'm special. That's the idea. Follow me. That's the idea. A leader worthy to be followed. And, of course, then it would be read different. Claiming to be somebody. That's the way we read it, see? Luke 17:9. Well, we don't have any King James people here tonight, do we? We need that good old King James Version here. But in Luke 17:9 of the King James Version, he does not thank the slave because he did the things which were commanded, does he? And the King James adds, I trow not. That's why you'd always want to read the King James. Everybody uses that word today, don't they? I trow not. In other words, it's an emphatic statement. Indeed, you know, he will not. Hebrews 13:17 is another example of understatement. Obey your leaders and submit to them, for they keep watch over your souls as those who will give an account. Let them do this with joy and not with grief, for this would be unprofitable for you. Well, there's a lot of things that are unprofitable that are no big deal. Is that what he's saying? Saying this would be disastrous. But it's an understatement to emphasize the opposite. Okay, so Paul is actually claiming inspiration in 1 Corinthians 7. And here in our text, of course, Mark's already pointed out the early part of the letter. And in our text in verse... in chapter 7, verse 17, he says, so I direct in all the churches. If he doesn't have the Holy Spirit of God, what is he doing directing in all the churches? In verse 26, he said, I think that it's good in view of the present distress. Is that again? I'm not sure. Maybe a question of doubt? Or is it sound counsel? And in chapter 4 and verse 9, he uses this I think phrase again. I think God has exhibited us apostles last of all as men condemned to death, etc. Was it a statement of uncertainty or a statement of affirmation? And so don't read that I think as uncertainty. Yes, there are people that will use verse 40 that way. So just be prepared, should you hear that, to be able to deal with it. Okay? All right. Now that we've got all those verses mastered, right? We're going to work on positions. Everybody have a copy of the lesson that says positions. Okay? You notice I have 13 listed. Whether we'll get through with all of them, I do not know. We'll be able, some of these, to go through a little bit quicker because they're based on the verses we've just been studying. The first one that we're looking at is the idea that men in the world, before they're Christians, are not under law to Christ. They're only under civil law. They're under no law of God. That being the case, there are no such sins for people in the world, such as adultery and fornication. Because sin is what? Violation of the law or transgression of the law. If they're not under the law that forbids adultery and fornication, then they cannot be guilty of that. You'll note I have Warren Fuqua debate. That was debated. You reckon anybody that studies the Bible would believe that? Oh, yes. Yes. Mr. Fuquay was a prolific writer, probably a pretty knowledgeable fellow. But he was wrong on this one. So in 1 Corinthians 6, 9 and 10, which we have studied, what in the text shows that these people were guilty of these specific sins, among which are listed, you can go back there and look, adultery and fornication. What shows these people were guilty of these specific sins while they were still in the world? Verse 11, such were some of you, but you were washed. So they were guilty of this before they became Christians. How could that be true if they were not under law? Could not be true. And it's not civil law. Civil law doesn't care whether you commit fornication or not. And so, in fact, in their society, homosexuality was widely practiced as well as fornication. According to Romans chapter 5, verse 13, what must be for these people to have been guilty of these sins?
Under law.
Sin is not imputed where there is no law, he said. So if they're guilty of these sins, they had to be under law. In Matthew 19, Jesus said it was unlawful for a man to divorce his wife. Look at Matthew 19, if you will. I want you to look particularly at verse 3. What's the question? Is it lawful? That's the question. Is it lawful? And so Jesus tells them, verse 6, no, you can't divorce. Verse 9, if you divorce for any other reason, if you put your mate away for any other reason, fornication, remarry, you commit adultery. So we have some questions. We've got three pairs of questions. A, B, A, B, A, B. And we ask you to choose of the pairs what from the text supports your answer. Of the first A, B, first pair, what did you choose? A, because of divine law. What in the text indicates it's because of divine law?
Have you not read?
Have you not read? Where? Genesis, right? Have you not read? So divine law, not civil law. Second, A, B. What did you choose? A, from the beginning. Says it in the text, doesn't it? From the beginning. Not only after baptism. The third pair, for all men or for Christians only. I know you chose A. What in the text indicates it's A? Somebody says, I don't agree with you. You just think that. What are you going to show in the text?
Still the fact that it references
from the beginning. Male and female, not Christian and Christian. Male and female. And he said, let no man separate. That's the law from the beginning. It's not about Christians. It's about people from the beginning.
And he was talking to Pharisees, which were Jews, of course, and this is before, you know, Christ died. And so, you know, he's answering the Pharisees.
Okay. All right. So, real quickly, that last question. Why are men lost? Romans 1, Romans 2, Romans 3. Because what?
They don't honor God
as God or giving thanks. Sin. Sin's why men are lost. And that is sin, what you said. Not because they don't know the gospel. They don't need the gospel if they ever sin. Sin is why men are lost. All right. We'll pick up with number 2.